from Burbank, California, where Kirstie Alley comes for dessert. It's the Mark Maron Show. And Al, he once sank himself to create a reef. Mark Maron.
Speaking of reefs, good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, and of course you need machines and pain sponges and whoever that shoe fits on. You know, how are you? Good. Great. This is the third of three, or the third, three of thirds, or there's three left, and this is one of them. How come I can't figure out how to say that? Three Mark Maron shows left, and this is one of them. Friday night, we'll be going live from San Diego at the Democracy Fest. You all right, Jim? Are you gurgling?
Yeah, I was gurgling.
Did it just come up on you?
I had some Milano Distinctive cookies before I came over here, but that's not important right now, Mark.
Sure it is. Milano Distinctive cookies in a juice box. That's important to people. I want people to know who you are. I think any little bits of information they can glean at this point, Jim, this is the last few days for them to glean it.
My father was part of the Greatest Generation, Mark.
Yeah, and you drink, what kind of juice box you got today?
I have Minute Maid 100% apple juice.
Okay, he's got an apple juice box, had some Milano cookies, and that causes a little gas that you get caught underneath your throat, and it kind of gurgled up on you, made a noise, and you weren't anticipating it.
No, I was not, but thanks for, you know, illuminating that.
I just want people to know who you are, Jim, because it's only a couple more days. And, you know, maybe you've got some other plans. You're going to pop up on radio shortly after the Mark Maron Show ends, and you're not telling me about it.
Yeah.
That's possible, and they'll go on knowing you. Perhaps you're doing a whole – maybe there's something on the Jim Rohl blog that says something about the future I don't know about. Maybe.
I really don't have any plans. I really can't tell anything right now, Mark. But for anybody listening out there, HBO
– Whoa!
I have a
really
new series coming out
called Jim Earl.
You might want to keep your eye out for that.
It's called Jim Earl Alone, finally.
Yeah. It's called Deadwood 2.
Deadwood 2 with just Jim Earl.
Just me lying in the bed with limp noodles.
Well, we got limp wood. Nice. We got a good show. I tell you, the last few shows are going to be good. Friday night, we are going live from Democracy Fest in San Diego. You can go. That's 14th and 15th down there at the San Diego State University campus. I'm going to be there. Jim's going to be there. Sweepy Bill. Andy's not going to be there. Sorry, buddy. Only got two more days with Laughing Andy. Al Franken's going to be there. Maxine Waters, Howard Dean. I get a call from the guy today. He's like, dude, Howard Dean's got to go on earlier, so maybe you could just be the headliner. I'm like, dude, how about not? How about putting me on a little before Howard Dean? I find that when people go to political rallies, they're not there to see the comic. You dig what I'm saying? They're there to be uplifted by bullcrap by one of the practitioners of politics.
You get more laughs like opening up for a rock show or something.
Oh, God, that's the worst. Opening for a rock show is a nightmare. One time I did a show at a green festival of some sort, or a green expo, and Dennis Kucinich went on after me, right before me, okay? The place filled up for Kucinich. It was in the schedule of who was going to show. I think I talked about this on this show once before. 500 people show up, pack the place out, fill every seat, people standing to see Kucinich. In the interim between me and Kucinich, the 10 minutes, 490 people filtered out. Yeah. I had an audience of 10. They're not there to see the comic, but I'm not going to complain. I got to set some stuff straight here, folks. It's going to happen. The truth will come out of my mouth, as I promised. I don't think this thing with Air America is going to work out. And I'll tell you exactly what happened, because I owe it to you. Although I don't know if it's protocol or practical or right or reasonable to talk about business, but I guess once business is done business, you might as well talk about business. Here's what happened. All right? Danny Goldberg pushed me out of the mornings because he didn't like me, and he was nuts. And he fired Jim and I. I think he single-handedly ruined Air America in New York and throughout the country in some respects, and they're still recovering from it. But that's old news. I don't have any resentment against him. So I was put out here to do a syndicated talk show. The original deal was to do an hour-long syndicated talk show from Los Angeles that would be syndicated across the country in all the Air America markets. I would also provide about 2 hours a week of supplementary material to the morning show that I left, not on my own volition. They decided they didn't want that, so I ended up with a two-hour show here in Los Angeles that was going to be syndicated. We fought tooth and nail to get this thing syndicated, do everything we could within our power sort of call Air America on it and make them syndicate. It would have taken nothing. They set us up in this studio And we tape it during the day with the intention of it going being syndicated. So as months went by, that wasn't happening. Why it didn't happen, I don't know. It would have been so easy to put it up there. And then it turns out they didn't want to syndicate it because they want to talk to me about coming back and doing mornings. Okay, folks, you know what I've gone through with this company. You know what I went through. I moved everything back here. I live with my wife. I got this beautiful schedule. We're doing this beautiful show. Jim and I, we're having a good time. And now they want me to do mornings. And I said, okay, I'll do that if you give me this amount of money. I'm writing it down on a piece of paper. You know how they do that? And I showed it, held it up. Okay, that amount of money. Okay? And they said, are you out of your mind? I said, well, look, that's what it's going to take to buy my conscience and not have to worry about you screwing it up again and to make my wife happy. Yeah, we ain't got it. And I go, all right, well, then I can't do it. Can we syndicate my show now, please? I got a deal. And they're like, hang out a minute. So I turned down that deal. Then I get another deal. You sure you don't want to do it? Are you sure you're sure about that thing you said? Yeah, I'm sure. Can we syndicate my show now? No, hang out a minute. Now, this, of course, these minutes are weeks. Days, eternities. So finally, you know, they fly out here. They say, here's the deal. We want you to do the morning show. I said, didn't I turn this down twice? I mean, you know, it's not that I don't want to do it. It's not that I wouldn't be good at it. It's not that I don't love my listeners and that Air America, I could turn that ship around over there. I know I can. But it just, you're not stepping up enough. And folks, I'm not greedy, man. I just want to be paid like a show business professional. And they said, that's all the money we got. And I said, well, I don't think it can happen. Let me think about it, though. So then I realized, wait a minute, here's what I'll do, Jim. I had a deal with them to do a syndicated show. They're not going to do it. So I have a piece of paper that says, well, if you're not going to do it, sorry, but you got to pay me. So I realized that, and I said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll do the morning show, or I'll think about it seriously, if you just pay me what you owe me for this not happening, and then we'll start talks about doing a morning show. I can't have both. You know, either you take the pay for the show that we canceled on you again for screwing you publicly twice, or you just come back and do the morning show and we'll just keep paying you the same we're paying you and we'll just roll it out like that. And I'm like, well, that seems crazy. So no, that's it. They weren't willing to pay me for my efforts on this syndicated show and do the morning show. So I chose to go ahead and, you know, have them honor the contract I have right now, and we'll part ways. So that's where it stands. That's what it's going to be. Jim, as far as you and I in the future go, I'm getting this out of the way because I don't want to get all teary on Friday. All right? As far as you and I are concerned, you know, I will gladly try to find a home for this show somewhere in the next couple of months. And I will do that. I do have a Comedy Central special to prepare for. I am in conversations with a production company at HBO, and I would love to do more radio as well. So that's what's going on, folks. There's the God honest truth. If you're disappointed that I am not a follow-the-money guy, go to where the work is, come on, man, who cares about your life? Come back to New York and drive the ship. If you're pissed off at me, so be it. I'm just not that guy. You know, I want respectable business practices. I want to be paid for the amount of time I spent in this business, and I want to be appreciated to that degree to where, you know, I feel supported and that it's worth my turning my life upside down completely to go back to that schedule. And that's just the truth. As much as I love doing radio and I love my audience, they didn't do it. They didn't step up to what they should, and I was not being greedy. So that's that. On the show today, we got Jean-Michel Cousteau, son of Jacques, and he's going to talk about his PBS series, Ocean Adventures. He did a shark one. That was pretty good. You watched the whale one?
Parts of it, yeah.
You watched the whale one. I watched the shark one. I think that what's interesting about these is, you know, his father really opened the eyes to everybody to what was actually in the ocean. And there was always the idea that it was precious. But it seems that what Jean-Michel Cousteau is doing is showing that, you know, we're in trouble. And the oceans are in trouble. And that's not just a subtext. That is the text of these shows. Whereas his father was like, look how amazing it is. Please appreciate it. Ari Berman, the nation's Washington reporter, will be on in a minute. And we'll go over news with him. Don't feel slighted on the news. Joe McHale, host of The Soup on the E! Network, will be with us. He's gunning for the big time. I can tell by this guy. I worked with him in Vegas. This guy's gunning for the Letterman spot. I'm going to talk to him about that. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
he's up in your junk, Mark Maron.
I'm up in your junk. I watched the 40-year-old virgin again last night. I hope you got a big trunk because I'm going to park my bike in it. I'm going to put my bike in it. That's the best line in the movie. Anyways, folks, Lieutenant Ronnie Rudolph has been a guest on our show, Army Lieutenant Ronnie Rudolph, many times. He's worked in recruiting. He's done ethics training. And now he wanted actually to come on and say goodbye. He emailed me. He heard that the show was ending. And that he said he had a proposition for me. So I to honor him for being a guest on our show, I decided I had him on. So here now on the phone, Lieutenant Ronnie Rudolph. How are you, Lieutenant?
I'm good, Mark, man. How are you doing?
Well, I'm all right. You know, I'm a little sad my show's ending.
Sure. It's a tough time. I understand that. And, look, I feel bad for you. I've enjoyed listening to your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to offer you a little something. I don't know if you're a Bible-reading man, but I believe somewhere in the Bible it says, when God closes a door, he opens a window.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to offer you a window that's open.
Okay. All right. Well, what do you got?
Well, it seems as though, you know, your show is going off the air, but I would like to offer you a new opportunity to bring your show to the U.S. Army.
Okay.
You know, like, as you might know, the U.S. Army has raised the enlistment age to 42.
Yeah.
And that's something before you said you felt you might be too old for the Army.
Yeah.
You're not too old. We can bring you into the Army.
Okay.
And we could get you a radio show just like Robin Williams had in Vietnam.
Uh-huh. Well, you mean in the movie?
No, Robin Williams had his own radio show in Vietnam. Like, it was great, and it did great things for his career. I know that, you know, you might not want to be an Army lifer, but, you know, maybe you want to do movies.
Uh-huh. I might like to do movies. I'm not sure about the Army thing, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure I'm not, that Robin Williams was a movie about Vietnam, and he actually, it wasn't real. He wasn't in the military.
I'm pretty sure it was a documentary.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I learned more things than I laughed at in that.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Well, you know,
I'm
we
sure
can.
It's a documentary.
Yeah.
I mean, so and look, the Army. Through many Army documentaries, a lot of great actors have come out of great Army documentaries.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Robin Williams went on to fame with Jumanji and RV and stuff like that,
yeah.
And then, you know, Platoon,
uh-huh,
did great things. Charlie Sheen served very well, you know, in the military, and then went on to Spin City.
Uh-huh.
And Johnny Depp became a pirate after spending some time in Platoon. And Jarhead did great things for Jamie Foxx.
Uh-huh. I think those are movies. Those are actors. Lieutenant Ronnie Rudolph, I understand that maybe the way you saw it, but I mean, there's been other movies they're movies. I got to be honest with you. Like, you know, Forrest Gump, what did you think of that movie? I mean, that was a movie.
No, Forrest Gump is part of the reason I joined the military, because I figured, you know, like, That was an opportunity. I mean, I looked at what happened to our American soldiers. Like, Garrett Sinise got his legs blown off and then went to grow them back and star in CSI New York. You know, that's real.
Okay.
That happened. That's, if I get shot, I'm going to grow it back. And, you know, like, if I lose an arm, it's not a big deal. If Garrett Sinise can grow two legs, I think I could grow back an arm very easily.
All right. Let me just understand your logic here. So you believe that if you get a career in show business after you're in the military, that you can't be hurt, basically, that the Army is a natural launching point for a career in show business, and that anything can happen to you, and it'll be erased if you get a different part.
I believe so, yes.
All right. Well, okay, let me just tell you something. The reason why you saw Robin Williams in Vietnam and you saw Robin Williams in Mork and Robin Williams in Jumanji is because he was playing a role. Tom Hanks was not really fighting the Nazis. Does Tom Hanks look old enough to fight the Nazis? He was not fighting the Nazis.
I thought somehow the Army had somehow found a way to cheat death.
Well, I think this
and
is
cheat the aging process.
No, I don't want to be the guy to burst your bubble or to cause you any distress, because I think you might want to see maybe a psychiatrist or somebody there at the health center. But
I don't want to stay here if that's not the case. I was hoping I'd be able to live forever. I don't want to stay in the Army if I could die.
Well, I think you might want to assess this, because I think you've been misled either by your own mind or somebody gave you the wrong information. But Lieutenant Ronnie Rudolph, those are movies. And movies, there is no magic. The magic is the movies. The Army doesn't have the magic. And those weren't documentaries. Those were fictional. And I think you maybe should go to the health center. They have a health center over there.
Wait, just let me get this straight. We don't have a bunch of Starship Troopers that we sent to fight giant cockroaches on another planet?
No.
No?
No, it's a movie.
I'm going. I think I had to go AWOL, Mark Maron. I can't stick around for this.
No, I know, but I think before you go running around, you know, in a panic, why don't you just go to the health center and see the guy for the psychologist, talk to somebody about this, because I'm surprised no one has told you this before. Maybe this is how they keep you guys in. I don't know.
No, you're right. I should talk to somebody. I should talk to the rest of the people in my platoon and tell them that Mark Maron said we should go AWOL because we're not going to live forever.
Yeah, well, yeah, that okay. Yeah, I'll let you do that, but I want you to take care of yourself and be careful. Because I just think you might be seeing it the wrong way. That's all. But
no, I'm gonna be careful. I'm gonna start a new life here in Baghdad. I'll maybe be an auto mechanic or something.
Well, okay, that sounds good. And there's no reason you can't try to be an actor. I think you just got to get this thing in perspective when you get out.
I'm getting out today.
Okay. All right. Well, Ronnie Rudolph, I'm glad we had this conversation. I feel that maybe you see things a little differently. And I again, want to thank you for being on my show so many times.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And thank you for telling me to drop out of the Army.
Yeah. All right. Well, you take care. Be careful out there.
Yes, you too.
Okay, man. Wow. Thank you. Oh, no. That poor guy, man.
No, but, man, you gave him good advice, though.
I was trying to be reasonable.
Well, yeah, I mean, but, you know, this is good.
Yeah, you know, when somebody has a meltdown like that, have you ever been in a situation where you realize that somebody's got real mental problems and you're not really equipped to deal with them properly? You have to sort of refer them or actually drive them somewhere where they need to go? Oh, man, I've had a couple of situations like that. There was one, a woman in New York, I don't have time to talk about it, who was hanging around the comedy scene, and she was right at that point where she was becoming paranoid schizophrenic. Like, she was normal one week, and then all of a sudden it was like, I'm booking a show at Madison Square Garden.
And you told her to get into the Army, and then...
Well, I told her that that paranoid schizophrenia was an immediate launching point to show business. And she ended up in the Bay Area.
You were right.
I'll be back with Ari Berman from The Nation.
It's time to grease up your light bulb for Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. All right, so now it's news time. Yeah, I decided not to talk about it at all by myself. Why would I? I've got Ari Berman on the phone. He's on the Washington beat for The Nation magazine. He's also a contributor to their breaking news blog, The Notion. He's here with us on the phone to crunch some news. How are you, Ari?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm glad you're on because I got to understand something. We've got this administration, we got the Department of Defense and the Pentagon all sort of saying that they're going to honor Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions at Guantanamo Bay Prison. They are even saying that they have treated the detainees humanely up to this point. But this honoring Article 3, is this for real? Is this just politics, as we head to November? Are they really going to honor it? Is there any way to tell?
Well, I think the Supreme Court didn't leave them much choice. If you go read the opinion, it says, you know, not only do you have to get approval from Congress, you have to follow Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. I think there were people in the administration who still don't want to follow Article 3 and who are maybe, you know, just going along with what the Pentagon's saying. However, I think there's a lot of people in the military that welcomed the Supreme Court's decision, that thought what they had before was confusing, and that then they thought that basically scrapping international law created a lot of the problems that we found in Abu Ghraib and Afghanistan and increasingly at Guantanamo.
But doesn't this mean, I saw a Department of Justice spokesman yesterday basically said that the provisions in Article 3 revolving around judicial treatment are vague. And I thought that was really the hinge on this. You know, torture is obviously very important, but isn't there something to be, don't they, does Article 3 address the idea that they need to be charged and they need to be treated with some sort of judicial fairness?
Yeah, I mean, Article 3 basically provides for sort of a basic ground-level amount of protections. I mean, what Congress is doing right now is trying to figure out how much rights, I guess you could say, that these prisoners, these enemy combatants, should be accorded. I think there's some people who believe, you know, that they should be tried in accordance with U.S. military justice. There's other people that believe that they shouldn't be, that they should be given very few rights, which is what they have now, which is basically no rights. I mean, no right to a lawyer, no right to know what evidence is against them. You know, they can be charged indefinitely. I mean, of the 450 people in Guantanamo, only 10 have been charged and none convicted. So anything would be better than what we have now.
Right.
I think it still remains to be seen where it goes and whether, even if they say they're going to follow Article 3, whether it's enforced, which is the big thing. I mean, they're the ones who are going to have to enforce it at their CIA black sites and at their detention facilities across the world.
You mean the black sites that they're relocating now so no one will find them again?
Yeah, and there was originally, when these black sites were discussed, some people thought they might be exempt from this Article 3 thing. So, of course, the CIA could just take people and torture them abroad instead of, you know, at home.
Sure, those are the
Cuba. But now they say that's going to apply, too. I think the CIA is still sort of mixed on that. I think it's, again, too soon to know.
It's the famous Pentagon torture junkets on Rendition Airlines. Well, look, let's talk a little bit about... The other day, Tony Snow comes out and he's addressing the crisis of what to do about North Korea. He goes out of his way to blame Clinton for bad policy in North Korea, because that's what they do. That's how they deal with things. But then, you know, initially Bush was talking tough. Now he's changed his tune. China's getting involved. Japan is considering an attack. Now, what is going on? How does this play out? Does Bush finally realize that the international community doesn't like him and that he has to play ball? What do you think?
Well, I basically think we have no policy on North Korea. It seems to change every single day. They refuse to negotiate with them. They don't really get into the six-party talks. They don't seem to have any sort of strategy to deal with North Korea. It's a big problem. Obviously, we're not going to attack them. It's just way too risky. But at the same time, we don't really seem like we're going to talk to them. We're going to let China talk to them, but China's complicated, and there's a lot of regional politics there. Right now, what we're trying to do is get a sanctions resolution in the UN, but China's probably going to veto it anyway. So I think what they have to do is they have to talk to North Korea like they said they're going to talk to Iran. Whether they do that or not, it's an open question, but I think they will eventually.
So,
they're running out of options. This preemptive doctrine they had just completely fell apart in Iraq, and now they're backpedaling everywhere because of it.
Oh, that's interesting. So basically they're going to have to do what Clinton did. They're going to have to go over there and try and appeal to this little lunatic. And also in Iran, I guess that's really what's happening, is that despite, you know, he went forward with this preemptive unilateral doctrine that has completely failed him, and that's good in a way, and now he really doesn't have the military might or the support of anybody to start bombing North Korea or bombing Iran.
Yeah, he's completely out of options. He has no choice but to negotiate. And I think, you know, the sensible people in the administration seem to realize that.
All right, so let's move on to Robert Novak, has cited Karl Rove and this CIA spokesperson, Harlow, as the sources that confirm the source that he's still not willing to reveal. I mean, what does this all mean, really? I mean, Rove is out of the woods, right? I mean, is this plain thing, is it over in terms of really implicating anyone but Libby?
Yeah, I mean, it basically seems to be wrapping up. But the Novak thing is, in many cases, just much ado about nothing. I mean, basically what he said is Bill Harlow, the CIA spokesman, and Karl Rove confirmed what my original source already told me, but he didn't say who his original source was. Now, most people believe that it was Richard Armitage, who was Colin Powell's deputy. His name has come up a lot. He hasn't said anything publicly about whether he is the source or not. Most people think he is. We'll find out eventually whether that's true or not. But I think one thing that Novak is doing is he's trying to cover up for Karl Rove, because he's basically saying Harlow and Rove performed the same function. Well, they didn't perform the same function. Harlow has told people that he told Novak not to publish Valerie Plame's name in his peace, which he did end up doing.
So do you agree with Jason Leopold that he wrote today, despite that guy's reputation as of late, that he is using a neocon tactic in blaming the CIA for these problems?
Well, I'm never going to say that I'm going to agree with Jason Leopold.
All right.
Based on his own reporting on this. But I do think that Novak is not telling the full story in his op-ed today.
Okay, and do you think that there is any chance that in the Libby trial that Dick Cheney could be implicated in anything? Is this going to go any further than a perjury charge on Libby?
It doesn't look like it. It doesn't look like at this point they've concluded that leaking the CIA agent's name was a criminal offense. Cheney may still end up testifying. It's certainly possible, but it doesn't look like he's going to be charged with anything.
Now, let's talk about...
they call Cheney as a witness.
Yeah, but the whole thing, I guess the sad thing is, as you know, from our point of view, from where I'm sitting, you know, on the left, is that, you know, we had really invested a lot of time and energy into thinking that this would be, you know, they were going to be able to shoot an episode of Cops right at the White House.
Yeah.
And now this thing has just dissipated into nothing. And, you know, and I got to be honest with you, I feel foolish for trusting certain journalists that we may have mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
It was just such a long haul for so little.
Well, this was also a scandal that was really a Washington-obsessed scandal. I mean, most average people didn't know what we were talking about and sort of thought, I think, that the media was spending an inordinate amount of attention on it. I think everyone would have, of course, made it more interesting if Karl Rove was indicted. But in a sense, this was a scandal that didn't seem to affect too many people, although it was obviously about the lying of the war, which affected a lot of people, of course. But we also thought there was going to be an episode of Cops filmed in Congress, right? Remember Jack
sure.
Abramoff?
Well, I mean, is that still possible? I mean,
it's still possible, but it doesn't seem likely that six congressmen are going to get indicted anymore. I just don't see it happening.
Oh man, we get so excited about stuff, and I feel bad that it's so disappointing because, you know, as we move towards 2006, there's such a vacuum in the Democratic leadership, and I just I had a moment when I don't usually have this because I got to talk about this every day, Ari. You know, I had this moment where I'm like, oh, we're screwed. What the hell happened? I mean, I'm looking at right now, I'm seeing that the Republicans are starting to turn the immigration issue on the Democrats, even though neither one of them really can commit to a stance on this thing. Somehow or another, they pass this legislation in Colorado where you're just going to blame the victims of this thing, as opposed to, you know, penalize corporations that hire these people or businesses that hire them, which I think would be a more appropriate way. But, you know, when you can be outwardly racist, it's got more teeth. And I think that they're going to be able to really rally with this thing.
Well, I think on the immigration question, I think most Democrats are relatively united. I think most of them support the McCain-Kennedy bill, which is somewhat flawed, but infinitely better than that version the House passed, which
yeah.
doesn't provide any sort of path to citizenship. I think we all thought originally when the House passed their bill that they were crazy, but they have sort of tapped this dark undercurrent of the American psyche, which is just completely afraid of immigrants and really is very worked up about illegal immigration, and in some places rightfully so. In some places it's just creating a boogeyman where none really exists. But what it's done is, in a year where the Republican base is disaffected, it's been able to rally Republicans. So, for example, in the special election in San Diego that Brian Bilbray won recently, immigration was basically the deciding issue. And I think that there's probably, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or maybe 10 races where Republicans may end up holding a seat they may have lost by running on illegal immigration. However, long term, I think the GOP has to be very nervous. This may kill their plan to elect George P. Bush in 2016 if they're not careful.
Which one? Who's going to run in 2016? The great
Jeb's son, Bush's Hispanic nephew.
Oh, are they thinking that far ahead? They probably are, aren't
that
they?
That is their master plan of the GOP. Talk to any Hispanic strategist, they'll tell you that.
Oh, that's I didn't even know that. That's great stuff. Thanks for that. So it just seems like, yeah, they've tapped into this weird racist threatened, you know, when they that frame of like how they're taking American jobs, that really resonates with a lot of people who are stupid and angry.
Well, and people who are angry, and what it also does is it allows them to separate themselves from Bush. So say, I'm not really a Bush Republican. I'm not really a Washington Republican because I want to crack down the border, and the president wants to give them amnesty.
Right.
So even though they've essentially agreed with Bush on everything, they're able to say that, well, on the big issue, we don't agree with them. So that's what Tom Tancredo is doing. That's what they're all doing. They're seeming like outsiders when they're really insiders. And it puts the Democrats in a weird place because they sort of agree with what's happening in the Senate, and they think Bush is doing a decent job on immigration, better than he's doing on anything else.
I guess I shouldn't say stupid and angry. I think people are angry in this country, but I think that this administration is never going to put the onus on corporations or create a penalty system where, you know, some of these illegal immigrants might go home on their own volition if corporations were not hiring them so much, and maybe open up some of these jobs to American workers and maybe enable the wage to be raised.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Republicans continuously block. I think they three times in the last 2 weeks they blocked any sort of discussion on the minimum wage.
So all right, so give me some.
Like Americans should care more about that.
Absolutely. So give me some hope on the Democrats and the war issue. Anything?
Well, I think the Democrats are actually getting better on the war in some cases. I mean, they rallied around this amendment a while ago that would, you know, get basically pull U.S. troops out without 2 years, a phased withdrawal. It's not great. I mean, obviously, they could be bolder. They could talk about it more. But they're making progress. Republicans are very divided on Iraq. They just seem united. Democrats are actually more united. They just seem divided.
Yeah.
And this is a big problem because Chuck Hagel in the Republican Party is in a very different place than John McCain is in the Republican Party right now on the war. But when it comes time to vote, they're together. Hillary Clinton is not that far away from where some other people are, but, you know, the positioning is different. I think it's a problem. I think Democrats should just talk about Iraq. I don't think it matters what they're saying. Just talk about it, because in the end, the war's not going well, and Americans recognize that it's the Republicans messed it up.
It's never been clearer that they've got no place in this war anymore, in this occupation, Americans, just in terms of the civil conflicts that are going on. Real quick, at the end here, this Lieberman petition, do you think the Republicans will carry him in Connecticut?
You mean,
Republicans
get him elected if he runs as independent?
Yeah.
I think he wins if he runs as an independent, because he'll get a lot of Democrats and quite a few Republicans. But I think this race is transforming the Democratic Party, and anyone who thought about acting like Joe Lieberman is having severe second thoughts right now about it.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Ari Berman. I appreciate you being with us.
Always good to be here. Thanks, Mark.
You take it easy. All right, Jim. So, okay, you're sitting over there fuming. You got something on your mind? What do you say we give the spin? Give the old wheel of anger a spin.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, this is interesting. How would it lands on Jim's ass? All right. When we come back, we'll get into Jim's ass, I guess, on the Jim Earl Wheel of Anger. All right, it's time for the Wheel of Anger, and evidently today's topic is Jim's ass.
Yeah, all right. Mark?
Yeah, Jim.
You know, last night after getting back from the studio, I spent the next six hours trying to figure out what the hell was wrong with my computer.
Uh-huh.
No avail.
Right.
And by to no avail, you ask, what do I mean by that? Because, well, there was nothing wrong with my computer to begin with.
Right.
And this morning, as I sat in my 3x5 office periodically looking out the window onto the street, to make sure nobody stole my license plates again, or parked in our driveway again, or defaced our no parking sign again, or passed out on our electric stun fence again, it happened yet once more. I couldn't send emails. Then I couldn't send emails with attachments. Then my internet went out. Mark, even a congenital idiot like you knows there are people dying all over the world right now.
Yeah.
There are massacres in Iraq. Trains exploding in India, airlines crashing in Russia, pain, tragedy everywhere, and each month I get screwed by my internet provider.
Yeah.
Each month I pay what you would call a crap load of money to the fine people at Adelphia to provide me with internet service. And you know where that crap load of money comes from, Mark?
I'm guessing your ass?
Wrong, Mark. Apparently it comes out of my You see, each month I have to reach up there with a claw hammer and a pair of tongs to get $23.95 to pay for so-called high-speed internet access not available in Puerto Rico. Yes, Mark, it's stressful. But is it as stressful as witnessing a massacre? Getting blown up on a train or crashing in an airplane? You bet it is! And each month I do it with the belief that the product I receive will be commensurate with the hard work it took to pay for it. But I guess I'm just a big stupid clown, Mark. A big stupid clown with gravy for brains and mashed potatoes for a penis.
Oh, man.
You see, I discovered that when I kicked my Apple computer, crashing those round speakers into the wall and upsetting our cat. But now I know I wasn't really kicking a cute little piece of molded plastic and wires in the shape of an apple. No, I was kicking injustice.
Yes.
Yeah, I was kicking war and poverty all over the world. To be more precise, I was kicking the board of directors at Air America and their collective incompetent ass. But even more important, I was kicking Adelphia Internet for making me miss my daily dose of painmaiden.com. And for that, you've all just taken a ride on my wheel of anger and up my...
Yes!
A Tandy company.
Jim Earl, you've been Earled. Yeah, I know how you feel there, Jim, about that. Those kind of little problems.
They take up your whole damn day.
Dude, I just called AppleCare today, and you get it. You know, they actually treated me very well. They didn't eat up a lot of my time, and they did get some resolution around a particular issue. But I don't do anything because of that. I literally let things sit just because I don't want to get into that time hole. Because anything you have to deal with, anything that's supposed to make your life more convenient, like a computer, a cell phone, anytime anything goes wrong with them, you enter this time vacuum where either you're sitting online for hours or you're waiting on a phone for hours.
Twice as much paperwork on the computer.
And what does it really facilitate? I still can't figure out how our life, I understand it's different and we've adapted to these things, but I don't know that the pace of my life or the things I get done are more. I don't know if they have multiplied.
All I know is that it made it more convenient for me to masturbate.
No kidding. And to a variety of things. That variety of things to masturbate to is something that technology has brought us. It's a gift. It's a gift. And you know, the amount – you remember what you had to go through to find filth when you were younger or before the internet? Like either you had to have that weird friend or you had to go buy it at those crappy stores. Now, you know, thank God my 14-year-old cousin helped me figure out how to do it. But you can just get right on – okay, I don't have a 14-year-old cousin. But I do.
I had to wait for my best friend's big brother to get back from NAMM. With firecrackers and some nudie pics.
Yeah, I just remember like there was a one kid at school that had that weird creased up piece of picture from a magazine that was all filthy and dirty. Or three pages from a novel that was like, you know, just horrendous about some guy having sex with his aunt and getting it. Boy, that really did me in for about 3 years. That really was it, that three pages. Man, I miss being younger. Anyways, we'll be back with Joel McHale. Stay with us.
He wrote the bestseller Sniglets. Mark Maron.
That was Rich Hall, actually, but I appreciate it. I'll take it.
No, man, you wrote that.
That guy, you know how much that bought that guy a ranch. In the studio, Joel McHale, my friends, has appeared on Will and Grace and Oliver Bean. I don't even know what Oliver Bean is.
It was a short-lived show on Fox.
I took this
from the IMDb.
I took it right off your IMDb. I took
his guiding light on there.
No, I actually took this off of your bio page. On E. I know the pain you're feeling right now because when people look at your bios and they always take the wrong things, I'm doing that to you.
No, it's that E updated that 2 years ago, so it's great.
Right. Well, let me finish it. Spider-Man 2. Spider-Man 2, you're proud of.
That's one. Yeah, that was
You're going to have to tell me who you were in that.
Yeah.
You're going to be in the Onion movie if it ever comes out.
I don't believe it's ever going to come out, but I like saying I'm in it.
Okay. The Lords of Dogtown, I saw that. Who were you in it?
I had a whole scene that was cut out, and it ended up being literally I said, thank you.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Oh, I remember that. That was genius. That was one of the greatest thank yous. You're also in the Burger King commercials, which I didn't need to do that to you. But
no, those paid me better than E does. So
I did one Sprint commercial by coincidence, and you're right.
It's really?
Yeah,
they're great.
Yeah, now you're the host of the Soup.
Yep.
On E, and we just worked in Vegas together. You did some stand up.
Well.
Yes. Now, you're not really...
I don't... I went out there and screwed around, and I got to interview that woman, and you did the real work. Where...
No, but you actually... It's interesting to me, because you never really did stand-up. People who do your job, and who do jobs in broadcasting like you, many of the big ones have done stand-up, mm-hmm. but you went and did it. You actually had your writer put together some stuff for you, and,
yeah.
and you went and did it, which is no small task to do that in front of a crowd.
Yeah, well, especially that crowd, which was really drunk, and Mark got them. You got... you were the last comic, so...
Yeah.
There was three other comics that went on, including your wife, who was great. And that one woman, man, was
well, it's weird
drunk.
When you have to get in front of that and you realize that there's a couple drunk people, you have to take them out. It's almost like military things. It's like, bam! You set them down, they try to go. But
And she was like Rasputin. She just kept getting back up, and just you kept knocking her down, and everyone was on your side, which was so great, and she just kept screaming.
Yeah, but then if you stay on top of them, you're ultimately, just as a comic or somebody with a dark soul, eventually you're going to say something so hurtful that the audience is going to go, hey, now wait a minute, buddy.
It was fine when she was about to vomit on you, but
now
how dare you?
Bringing up the uncle was wrong. That was wrong. Yeah.
But, I like it when you said, your friends are hoping you pass out so they can just put you back in your room and they can go out and have a good time.
Bam! But no, keep coming. It's like, no, I want more attention.
And then I remember she said, been there, done that, to something you had said. You were like, been there, done that?
What?
Yeah. Are you still saying that?
Yeah. I don't even remember how that went. But how did you start, though? You did do comedy of some kind.
Yeah, I did a lot of improv, and I came here as an actor, and I actually have a graduate degree in acting. I'm one of those guys who I trained, actually.
But it paid
off.
See,
I'm using it? Well, yeah, kind of.
No, what are you kidding me? Most people who get acting degrees, they end up teaching at acting school.
That's
And then they end up, if they're lucky, getting into some other line of work.
Oh, yeah.
Or giving up the dream.
Or some of my friends in New York who were like, Joel, good news. Guess what? What? You get a part? No. I qualified for low-income housing.
Right.
I'm living on 42nd Street for $400 a month. And I was like, great job, Mike.
That's one of those stories when I hear people in the business who get on unemployment. There's something like, I understand that's good and you got some income, but I'm not sure unemployment is really for them.
Yeah, it's not.
But maybe it is. You got anything on that, Jim?
Yeah, it will be for me soon. Thanks for bringing it up, guy.
You get half of, what is it? I forget what it is. But I'm very happy. I just never thought that I would be telling people how bad I think television is or how stupid celebrity behavior is.
But you've taken a show that was a daily show that originally started out as, I think it was for soaps primarily.
Yeah, soaps and talk shows.
Right.
Talk shows, yeah.
And that was the original guy was it Kinnear?
It was Kinnear.
Original? Right.
He was the first one. In 91, I think.
Right. And then John Henson had it for a long time.
4 years, yeah.
And he has completely disappeared.
He has a show on the TV Guide channel.
Again, completely disappeared.
Oh.
I knew Henson when he was a stand-up.
Was he? I don't even know.
Yeah, he was a...
You were in the same circles, or he just kind of came
across? He's a class under me, actually. I think I was in the class after him.
Okay.
And
then it was Hal Sparks.
Hal Sparks, and he... I don't know what he does.
He did Queer as Folk, which, would be tough to tell your parents that you got that pilot, but it was a very successful show.
Is he gay?
No.
Oh, okay.
Which would even be more, interesting to kind of pull that
up. So he had it for a while, but what I was getting at is now it's a weekly show, and you've actually broadened it out, and you do some fairly sophisticated bits. You do sketches.
Yeah.
You're funnier than the rest of them. I think Kinnear had a way about him that I never got that guy, and everyone always said they liked him, and now he became this huge actor.
Huge. He went from Talk Soup to Sabrina with Harrison Ford.
Now, in terms of...
I'm hoping to eat another Burger King ad.
Yeah, what is your goal with something like this? Because it seems to me that you're sort of... You look like the right kind of guy to do real talk show, to do an evening talk show. You know, they usually like kind of white, tall, Midwestern-looking folks.
Yeah.
That was the classic the classic model, Johnny Carson and Conan, Jack Parr.
Yeah, if they'll have me, I would love it. But as I'm sure as that those jobs are like...
There's three of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah. like the hard, yeah, you have to, it's like getting, becoming a mafia don or something. You, it's so dodgy, and not dodgy as in shady, but just like it's so difficult. I mean, I would love to, but.
Yeah, the last time that window really opened in a real way was when Lorne was looking to fill that spot
yeah.
after Letterman left. Or
yeah.
After, yeah, that's who it was, right?
And there was frickin' movies made about that.
Yeah, I mean.
I said frickin'.
That's all right. We could bleep anything. But I remember when Conan, before Conan, they were doing general calls mm-hmm. to, and
oh,
looking
were they
at
really?
People. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Stewart was, you know, in the game, and they looked at, like, a bunch of other folks, because Lorne was looking at this as weird experiment that he was doing, and Conan's got this gig that's going to last him his lifetime.
Yeah. Man. Did you see the episode where he went to Iceland?
No, I
mean, to Finland?
I didn't.
Oh, it's really great, where he looked like the president.
So, do you do interviews on your show?
We have done not real. We've done kind of fake interviews. Not really. I've always been. I want to make sure that the show moves along at a pace and does not try to compete with like the Daily Show.
Right.
Because that show was so fantastic that I want to keep it kind of separate and like its own thing of always reflecting or making fun of. Like this week we're going to interview Tom Cruise and Katie.
For fake.
Oh, of
I get that's right.
You know.
So you recut things to have that.
Yeah,
the question.
We
answer.
Recut them.
Right.
This one actually we cast actors and. We're going to, because Suri supposedly doesn't exist, so we're going to make a lot of fun
oh,
of that.
Really?
Well, there's the rumors, because this baby has never been viewed, ever.
I heard that he actually, that the two of them sacrificed her and ate her in a Scientology ritual.
Was it? Now, I heard that, but I don't know if she was eaten.
Oh, you don't? You just heard
I heard the sacrifice, but the eating part, maybe.
Sacrifice
stuffed,
on the...
Stuffed, possibly.
On the L. Ron Hubbard altar.
Yes.
So, well, that sounds funny.
Yeah, it should be good. I mean,
well, where are you going to get your chops as an interviewer? You got to start preparing, Joel. Where you got to go out and do it? You got how come you?
You
don't
know,
have
I did interview the of all things. I interviewed the American Idol judges.
Wow,
it was quite a trip.
And did they judge your interviewing skills?
I think Randy Jackson did. He kept giving me that look, like you know that look he always gives the singers after that. But that was for online, and I kind of was like, all right, I'll do that because it's not going to be on the air. And I can hopefully control the interviews with my questions, and I think they turned out fine. Simon Cowell was actually a really great guy. I liked him a lot.
Really? He's a nice guy for a billionaire for having nothing?
I mean, yeah, for the show that he's doing and the way he talks to me, I was like, wow, he's the guy I really want to hang out with.
What do you think of those shows, man? What's that one, America's Got Talent?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
that's his baby, too.
No, I know, but I mean, as a person, as a human being
yeah.
with a critical mind, as a funny guy, don't you think that somehow or another they should be outlawed, those shows?
With those ones, I feel like with American Idol and with America's Got Talent, they're talent shows, right? They're essentially the old time, like, you go up on stage and let's see what you can do.
Well, okay, fine. That may be true. But back then, you won a gift certificate for Farina cereal
right.
or something.
You didn't become a megastar.
You got to meet Steve Allen.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't get a record deal and a touring contract and a free pass to lower the bar.
Yeah. But when you get 40 million people watching your talent show,
yeah.
it changed. But my problem is with the shows that are like Big Brother
yeah.
or The Real World,
yeah.
where they only show the tedium of life. And they
right.
show, they want people to bicker, and they want people to be the lowest common denominator. And they drive me insane because it's just people whispering to each other and conspiring against each other. And it's just, it's not good for people. And The Real World, they just get a bunch of okay people and then one really screwed up girl, and then they get drunk every night.
Yeah, but it seems to me that in terms of reflecting and actually being not good for people, to sort of, you know, tease people
yeah.
with the idea that if they just mock talented people, that they will be given the gift of stardom.
Some of them are talented.
Okay.
Don't you think? Don't
yeah.
you think some
no,
of them
no,
are?
I guess so.
Some of them are okay. I mean, I can't believe I'm defending them, but but I was like, okay, all reality shows can't be horrible.
No,
but,
I get choked
but,
up.
But you see, you get caught up
no,
with these.
I don't get caught up. I get choked up because I know when people are trying. I
yeah.
know when you see
that real struggle.
Well, you see someone out there doing their best.
Yeah.
That it is endearing, and you know I'm being sort of hard on them. Maybe this is all coming.
But then you see a show like Laguna. I don't know if you've ever seen Laguna Beach on MTV, which is a staged reality show.
Yeah.
Where they tell people what to say, and it's so strange, and that is the devil, and it's not real, and it's not fake, and it's just, and it's hugely popular, but it is really terrible.
I guess, you know what's honest, I think honestly in my heart that when I was a kid, and I think when you were two, you're not that much younger than me, that when we were growing up, that there was a certain amount of class to show business, that mm-hmm. It was a smaller world, there were three channels, even before cable, that there seemed to be an insulated group of people that took the responsibility of being entertainers.
Yeah.
And now it just seems like a mess. And I think some people would argue with me that there's been a democratization of the show business industry by virtue of cable and the internet, which is all fine. It's all entertaining and everyone can go find their own thing. But there's not very many people left in show business mm-hmm. with any gravitas.
I think you're right. The three networks were like a huge, you know, with the frosting that pushes through the little thought. That it had to be good because of the competition was so fierce and it had to be. Now that it's just this vast array of channels and this just too many, that it's 90% of everything is bad.
And a lot of it feeds on itself in the sense that, you know, in your show is a criticism of show business. That's our point of reflection. But it's very funny because the weird thing is that's our reality. That's our whole perception.
Is that, and people accept it as fine. But he's like, look, people, you're watching a show about Janice Dickinson, who clearly needs some help. She shouldn't be running a modeling agency.
Yeah.
And it's a huge hit.
I know. Maybe I'm just getting old and spiteful.
No, I don't think people are critical enough about how bad television is right now, and probably will continue to be as long as there's more channels being added, and we need to... We need the good shows and tell people that they're good.
Why you're here, Joel.
See?
Joel McHale is with us. Maybe he'll be with us in a minute. Maybe he's going to hang out.
I want to talk about the shark endangerment.
Okay. All right. So hang out. We got another bit, and then we'll have you back in when we get Jean-Michel Cousteau on. Stay with us.
Hello.
Depression is linked to obesity.
Yeah. Joel McHale stepped out. He's going to come back in when we talk to Jean-Michel Cousteau. It's hard not to be a Cousteau fan, but we had to leave the chair open here because there are a lot of stories here. The chair is filled with royalty, my friends. There are a lot of big stories in the news this week, so let's get some bets down with our own Inside the Beltway oddsmaker, Johnny K Street. Johnny, where's the action, man?
Follows me, baby. Well, Mark, as we say here in Tinseltown, we are now in Act 3 of the Mark Maron Show.
Oh, yeah.
Credits are about to roll.
Oh.
But I know that whatever happens with the show, you'll always make a beautiful dollar in this business.
Really? You think so, Johnny?
You better hope so. The last time I checked, you were into me for a 58 large, 430, and the VIG is still running. I'm trying to be optimistic here. Give me that, okay?
All right. Well, let's get a bet down on one last time there, Johnny. What do you say?
Last call. Get your money down.
All right.
The big bet right now is who is going to launch a missile next. First it was North Korea shooting off one dud after another. Now India has joined the party. None of these missiles are hitting anything. They're just dropping into the ocean. I haven't seen this many failed launches since Planet Hollywood went bankrupt.
Yeah.
Each day a war with North Korea looks more and more like a lock. We have an insane dictator who is sitting on nuclear missiles, pissing off the entire world, ready to start a nuclear war, and we have Kim Jong-il. Not to mention Iran. I'm giving 100-1 India launches again and 1,000-1 Iran launches a nuclear missiles they don't have next. Uh-huh. Take your pick.
All right. Well, I'm going to take India for $5, Johnny.
You are down. The other big bet this week is Novak. He revealed two of his sources in a Valerie Plame case. One was Karl Rove and one was CIA spokesman Bill Harlow. Even money, number three is our very own president, Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Outing Valerie Plame was Rove and Cheney's way of getting back at all the hot girls in school who wouldn't give them the time of day, no matter how much they offered to steal the answers to the test. Cheney, even money, and consider it a going-away present.
All right, well, you know, what the heck? Put me down for 1,000 scoots, man.
You'll thank me.
So what other action are we looking at this week, Johnny?
I think you know, Mark.
What do you mean?
Well, I wasn't going to get into this, but the big bet this week is what's next for Mark Maron? I know Air America's been making you offers to stay. From what I hear, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's now up to a 5-figure deal.
Yeah, man, they're breaking the bank on this one.
And they promised to put you on a station with a signal that reaches farther than a square block and can't be jammed by a garage door opener.
Well, I don't know where you're getting that information, but you're right on the money, my friend.
Okay, hear me out. I want you to put the dreams of hosting Talk Soup, playing cards, and celebrity poker showdown with Anson Williams and Soleil Moonfry, hosting a segment of We Love the 80s on VH1, or sharing a room in the Surreal House with Tone Loc for a season aside for just a second.
Do I have to? Go ahead.
I just want to put this out there, if I may.
Yeah.
When the show is over, there will always be a place for you at K Street Productions.
K Street Productions?
My new film and television production company.
Uh-huh.
I feel like you're responsible in some way, not a big way, a small, non-legally binding way, for the birth of K Street Productions. Mm-hmm. During my trips here to the City of Angels to be on your show, I've been lucky enough to have been approached by some very deep-pocketed partners who, along with myself, want to return the movie industry back to the creative heights it reached during the 70s with films like The Godfather, Chinatown, and, of course, Rocky, which is why K Street Productions is one of the main investors in Rocky VI.
Rocky VI?
Mark, this movie is going to return the Rocky franchise to its former glory.
Ugh.
Oh, I know. We've all heard the jokes. In Rocky VI, Sylvester Stallone runs up the steps of the Philadelphia Library, checks out a book on gardening. Rocky punches a side of beef, and the side of beef knocks him out to become world champion. But I can tell you, Sylvester Stallone is going to surprise everyone. He's in the best shape of his life. He has the body of a 40-year-old.
Well, that definitely sounds like a hit, Johnny.
Tell me something I don't know. Plus, I'm pretty excited about a brand new project we'll be starting in September. It's a remake of Sophie's Choice, starring Kirstie Alley and the Olsen twins.
Come on.
How do you pick which one lives and which one dies? They're both so damn cute. It was a no-brainer. And the great thing is they both have those starved-to-death concentration camp bodies. They are camera-ready.
Wow, Johnny, I am speechless.
Mark, before I leave, let me run something by you,
okay? Yeah.
Now keep an open mind.
All right.
The Brothers Karamazov with Jamie Kennedy and Mark Maron. We update it, change the script a little, we get the Black Eyed Peas to do the soundtrack, then we both buy trucks to haul the money to the bank. Don't give me your answer yet, sleep on it. I'm staying at the Chateau Marmont. Lunch tomorrow. Let's make magic, baby. I'm out of here.
At least there's opportunities for me out there, huh? Thanks a lot, Johnny. The Chateau Marmont is where he's at. We'll be back with Jean-Michel Cousteau and Joe McHale is still here. And that's that. We'll talk to you in a minute. And now, thank you, Jim. Joel McHale's still here. He didn't want to leave.
Is that okay?
That's fine, because we're all big Cousteau fans. And we're going to be talking now to, as you know, Jacques Cousteau was and is a household name. When I was a kid, we would look forward to the underwater specials that he had on TV. He changed the way we see the ocean and made it a living place for the entire world to really see. His son, Jean-Michel Cousteau, is followed in his father's footsteps. This month on PBS, there are two Jean-Michel Cousteau ocean adventure specials airing. Sharks at Risk is one, and the Gray Whale Obstacle Course is the other. He's on the phone with us now. Welcome to the show, Jean-Michel Cousteau.
Thank you very much.
I'm very glad you're here. Now, I remember when I was a kid, the nature of your father's show was always to respect the ocean and its life. But it seems now the message is much more urgent. In your specials, the oceans are and their life are in grave danger, it feels like.
Well, we continue to use the ocean as a garbage can, whether we live along the coastline or way inland. We continue to destroy all the coastal habitats, which are so important. They act like nurseries for a great majority of marine life creatures and birds as well. And then we continue to empty the ocean from the fish resources because we're doing it in a non-sustainable way. And it's heading toward bankruptcy, and I feel very sorry because I'm not a hypocrite. I eat fish, and I love to see the fishermen being able to keep their jobs. So I'm on their side, but we're doing such a bad job of managing those resources, and it has a lot to do with the way these people are under the gun all the time to make their payments and whatnot. So,
right.
You know, it's very, very sad to see that our life support system, which the ocean represents, is being trashed. And that ultimately affects the quality of our lives.
Well, let's talk about that, because the shark special is profound, because you're talking about an animal that is really at the top of the food chain in the ocean. And you're what was the island area where you shot that, the atoll, the reef? What was that called? Where all the sharks were?
We've been to two different locations. One was in South Africa.
Yeah.
And the other one was in French Polynesia on the island or the atoll of Rangiroa.
Yeah, that place. That was amazing. Now, what kills me here is that 100 million to 200 million sharks are killed every year, probably. But for shark fin soup, this is a luxury. This is it's unnecessary. Isn't there any way we can get those people to eat something else?
Well, you know, it started from a cultural issue, and then it became a fad, and it has to do with status. It has to do with sexual gratification, they say. And in fact, what's more, even more shocking, is that if amongst those 100 million or more sharks, which are for the most part killed for their fins, while their carcasses still bleeding to death are being dumped back overboard, while over a billion people are starving, are malnourished, make less than a dollar a day, I don't understand. And at the same time, we're now getting more and more scientific evidence that in those fins, in many species, there is 40% more mercury than is normally accepted or acceptable for human health. So these people are seeing, they're having their nervous system being affected, and if you're a pregnant woman, that is transmitted to your child, and, you know, even before that creature's had a chance to exist.
Well, so now, you know, we talked about the dark realities of what's at risk, but I don't want to undermine our conversation in the sense that the photography is beautiful. There are obviously still places where you are able to go and document, the ocean life and all its beauty. And it seems to me that the technology now with the cameras gives you so much more range than your father had, certainly. And I imagine you're at the cutting edge of this technology. I just thought it was stunning, with some of the work you guys were able to do underwater.
Well, you're very kind. It is true that I wish my dad was around, because today we have between the HD cameras, which hold 50 minutes of video, and the rebreathers, which allow us to stay 2-3 hours underwater, it really has improved our efficiency and allows us to see way into sometimes not very clear water. Now, one has to realize at the same time that we have about 400 species of sharks that are roaming the ocean. The majority of them are completely harmless. There's maybe 5 or 6 species that have caused accidents out of 400. The biggest fish in the ocean is the shark whale, the whale shark, which can be 30 feet or so in length or even more. And nobody cares because it has no teeth. Now, there's adult sharks that are 6 inches long. I was holding one this morning. And, you know, those are not man-eaters. So we've been misled, or lack of knowledge has been abused, and all of that most of the time for financial gain at the expense of the public, which fear these animals when there is really, in most instances, no reason to fear them. And the best thing to do is to learn about those 5 or 6 species, know where they are, and don't do the wrong thing. Don't go when the water is turbid, when there's blood, when there's chumming, when there's fishing, spear fishing,
sure,
or collecting.
Yeah.
And then you'll stay out of trouble. I've been diving almost 61 years, and I'm still alive.
Well, I tell you, you definitely see that in the shark video, because you guys are just hanging out with literally hundreds of sharks, and you really get that sense that not only of their beauty, but that they really are not a threat to humans. My buddy Jim here watched the whale special, the whale obstacle course. He's got a question for you.
Yeah, just a general question. Is there any hope for the gray whale?
Yes,
at this
absolutely.
Point?
You know, the gray whales have been protected for a long time. And the good news is because they are going along the coastline, so you can keep an eye on them. And very early, long before the Marine Mammal Act was created in 1972, the the country of Mexico, the United States, and Canada decided to protect that particular species because it was on the verge of extinction, and it has made a pretty spectacular recovery. And although there are ups and downs, and it's not yet back to its normal numbers, the bad news is that they are under a lot of stress. And the reason is that this migration, which is a coastal migration, 10,000 miles round trip, is precisely where we're impacting the ocean with our garbage, with heavy metals and chemicals and fertilizers, and we also making a lot of noise, which is really hurting these animals and all marine mammals, and particularly dolphins and whales. And those sounds are from all kinds of sources, whether it's the propeller of a ship or whether it's exploring for mining or the low-frequency, mid-range frequency, which the United States Navy is emitting along the coastline during exercise. And that affects them, and then the food, which they normally prey upon, appear to be sometimes affected to the point where they have to spend a lot more time to get the same amount of food, and sometimes their immune system just crash because it's too much energy spent to get less food or not enough food. So they are doing okay. They've been removed from the endangered species list. It is the only marine mammal that has been removed from the endangered species list. So it is good news, but it doesn't mean they're back to their normal state.
Well, our guest is Jean-Michel Cousteau. Our buddy Joel McHale is still here in the studio. He's a big fan of yours and your dad's. He wants to ask you a question as well.
An honor to speak to you, Mr. Cousteau.
Well, thank you.
What do you think Zidane's reputation will be now after he headbutted that Italian in the World Cup game?
I'll tell you, I was as offended as anybody can be, and that was totally unacceptable. I don't know what exchange of words took place on the court. That could have been solved afterwards.
Do you think he should have still gotten player of the tournament?
No.
All right.
No, I think, and it's not a tournament, I think it's a world or something.
Right.
I'm sorry to say that this has happened. When you're the captain of a team, when you become a legend, you have absolutely no excuse. As much insulted as he may have been, you have to control yourself, otherwise you're not supposed to be the captain. And I say to that, bravo Italia.
Yeah. You've never gone down for a dive, photographed something, and then just punched it, right?
Well, a lot of my colleagues I like to punch.
All right, okay,
but I'll tell you one thing.
Maybe a gray whale.
I'm not going to punch them underwater.
Maybe he should have been thrown to the sharks for headbutting that guy.
Well, they probably wouldn't want to eat him.
So now, what have you got planned? These two, I know, the Sharks at Risk airs tonight, I believe.
Yes.
And the Gray Whale Obstacle Course airs next week on the 19th. What do you got in store for us after these two?
We have two more shows coming in September, on the 20th and the 27th.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be about the United States marine sanctuaries, which are called in our shows America's Underwater Treasures.
Okay, well, that's great. It was a pleasure talking to you, Jean-Michel Cousteau, and I love your work. It looks beautiful.
You're very kind, and thank you for having us on your show.
You bet. Take care of yourself.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
You know what's interesting is that he had a dog shark in his hands this morning, and so did I. It was a coincidence.
You're kidding.
You had a dog shark? Really?
Well, that's what I call it. We'll be back with Joel McHale, who's still here, and Jim, and whatever we're going to do at the end of this thing. Does it matter anymore? Stay with us.
He's got a tiny orange laptop, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Joel McHale still with us. Hi, Joel.
Hello, sir.
Wasn't it nice to talk to Jean-Michel Cousteau?
Oh, man. It's like, you know, I grew up with the Cousteaus.
Awesome.
You're a legend.
You know what I've been doing? I've been listening to, we're going to get to it. Jim, obviously, you blog people are waiting for the selections he made to finish his bit yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
But I do want to say that my stepmom, Rosie, let me download a lot of her country music CDs. And I had no idea. I had no idea. Like, the guys who I think knew country, like Alan Jackson, Clint Black, Toby Keith, what's the other guy's name? There are a couple other ones. These guys, they're 10 years old already, and I never knew this whole world existed. They've got big hits. And I got
they're billionaires.
Yeah, but I never listened to any of it. And I got to be honest, a couple of them, they're all right. They're all right. Alan Jackson's all right. Clint Black's okay. I mean, it's country music.
You would get in your car tonight and put in a Toby Keith album.
No, he stinks. I mean, I gave him a shot because I know he's an ass politically, but I wanted to hear what he was as an artist. And he's the hackiest of all of them. Doesn't have the chops. Doesn't have the voice. But Alan Jackson and Clint Black have the pipes. They're not bad. And some of the songwriting's pretty good.
Are they all just kind of like overproduced and strings and with a...
There's no strings, but there's
low,
definitely...
Low voice and that kind
no,
of thing.
No, the voices are fairly distinct, but the musical production is fairly hackneyed. But it's fairly specific. It's definitely a Nashville sound. It's definitely a country sound, but they're really highly polished studio players that have no real style other than just generic country. But that's why I had to assess them in a certain way. I knew I was going to be trying to assess songwriting and vocal ability. And I think Alan Jackson is okay, and I think Clint Black's pretty good. Lyle Lovett's got a great voice. But Toby Keith stinks, and I'm glad I can say that on all levels. He stinks politically, and he stinks as a country artist. And I'm still, I got to listen to George Strait. Is that the guy's name?
Yeah.
And a couple of the other ones she had. I just wanted to get hip to him. I did not do any Brooks and what's his name.
Because
they look, yeah, they look ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right, Jim, what do you got?
Well, yesterday, I put this out to the bloggers, our great blogging audience, to complete the joke on Peter Smithers' obituary.
Yeah.
The guy who was the model for James Bond.
Yeah.
Ian Fleming's James Bond. And we got a few responses. We got like 10 responses here. And, some of them were just, they were pretty good.
Well, lay a couple on us.
Well, Smithers requested his remains not be buried at sea due to his fear of octopuses galore.
Yeah.
I didn't even understand that one. That was MRD in NYC.
Yeah, I've had my issues with that person.
Okay, here's the... Smithers requested his remains be cremated, not interred.
Yeah.
That was R.C. Towns. Okay. You know, that's kind of predictable.
That's all right.
Webster Hubble Telescope sent this one in. In lieu of flowers, Smithers requested an in-posterity name change to James Bond, limited edition to differentiate him from the cartoon character from The Simpsons and that cute but shy chick that played Bailey on WKRP. Really wordy.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Very wordy on that one.
That was a punchline.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even. Okay, Smithers requested his remains be gently folded into a chocolate Grand Marnier souffle and served to Daniel Craig at dinner the night of the Casino Royale opening. Okay,
good. That's a good reference.
Yeah.
And it's creative.
MJK sent that in.
All right.
You want me to get to the two best ones, though?
Thanks again for the German candy.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, go ahead. And the tonics, the German herb drinks. I enjoyed them. Made me feel better.
And the two German beers. Yeah, those are great.
Good for you. All right. Yeah, let's do the two good ones.
Yeah, two best ones. Yeah, that was Old Zeb between Old Zeb and Orbit Boy 2.
Old Zeb from New Orleans.
That's who it came down to.
Yeah. Old Zeb lives in New Orleans, and Orbit Boy, Blake, lives in Austin.
All right. Yeah, this is Old Zeb. This is what Old Zeb said. And Smithers requested that his remains be buried between Sean Connery's hairpiece and George Lazenby's career.
I
kind of like that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably... but this one is it right here. Orbit Boy did it. Smithers requested that his remains be placed in Barbara Bush's vagina.
Yes, Barbara Bush's badge.
Yeah,
where everything happens.
That was just unexpected and out of nowhere, and I respect that highly.
And in reference to the previous show, everything happens.
Yeah.
World War III is going on. It all started in Barbara Bush's badge.
There were many. There
all
were many
the world's
other
problems.
There were other submissions too, and they were all equally. They were all very nice.
Well, Joel, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. That was amazing.
And Jim, thank you for throwing them a bone and giving them an opportunity to be creative, the blog people, on our last few days. We will have a call-in segment on Friday because we are going live from San Diego at Democracy Fest. You can go to markmaron.com and hit where it says here to find out details on that, and I'll give you the number. Man, I'll post that number on the blog tomorrow. because I know Shawnee Shawns is going to be on the road, and he's going to be in his truck, and he might not be able to get to the blog. We got a blog guy that is a little nuts, and he's a truck driver. Here we go. Here's your short order news for today. Family and friends of Enron Corporation's founder Kenneth Lay began saying their goodbyes in the same peaceful mountain setting where he died last week of heart disease. Far more will do the same a few blocks from the failed energy company's former headquarters, where Lay was once hailed as a visionary business leader. Many found the service particularly spiritual, since Lay's death seemed to prove that there is a God. At one, the former mayor of Houston actually collapsed. The mayor says he's fine and was just doing his impersonation of Enron. Huh? All right. Yeah. At least 12 tons of concrete collapsed into a car in a Big Dig tunnel, fatally crushing a passenger and prompting renewed scrutiny of the troubled highway project that is already the costliest in U.S. history. With the Big Dig's delays, leaks, and now a collapse, it looks like the project manager must be bucking for a job at FEMA. Boston police still investigating the incident, since many of the eyewitnesses described the accident only as retarded. It's retarded.
Mr. Carter.
Retarded. It's similar. It's Boston and Brooklyn. Yeah.
Bobby.
People who took an illegal drug made from mushrooms reported profound mystical experiences that led to behavior changes lasting for weeks, all part of an experiment that recalls the psychedelic 60s. One patient said the dosage wasn't enough, blaming the idea that space by itself and time by itself are doomed to fade away into mere shadows, and only a kind union of the two will preserve an independent reality.
I like that.
You like that, right? Nice. One patient said she thought she talked to God until she realized God wouldn't grab her ass and ask her to make out with her.
Yeah, he would.
Probably, depending on what, you know.
My God would.
That's it. That's a show. Yeah, I think sometimes the setups on those are long.
Well, you sent one of them.
I know.
Just say Barbara Bush's badge, and then it'll all be.
Yeah, we're all just, she's got the whole world in her badge. All right, here we go. Tomorrow, Lon Friend, in a book about rock and roll. Ellen Perry from a PBS series, and John Dean from the Nixon administration. Good night, sheeple. It's a dark, dark place.